Well, now we have about 15 minutes for audience Q&A. All right, I see three hands. Why don't we collect those questions, and then we'll give a chance for the speakers to respond. So I see Rachel, Dee. Yes, right over here on the left. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Russell and Chief Chat and Cedar Center. It's a really excellent panel. I'm Rachel Burton with the Project 2049 Institute. Covering a lot of these issues at our own institute, so it's really wonderful to have this discussion here. I have one comment and then a question at the end of it. First, to Toshi, to your question about United Front Work in wartime. The one incident that really comes to my mind in terms of history is really looking at the role of United Front Work in Tibet while the PLA was annexing Tibet, and the role that United Front Work did in terms of coming in behind the PLA and how that was set up, and you know, United Front Work activities in Tibet from the 50s to this day, I think is an understudied case. And then I came to address the sort of the panel's answers to Taiwan's role in countering ceasefire political warfare. I want to flip that question a little bit and ask the panel, you know, for the United States under the TRA and our obligation to the TRA, what can the U.S. do to extend legitimacy to the government of Taiwan in order to counter the CCP political warfare? Is there something we can do to extend legitimacy to the government of Taiwan underneath an Indo-Pacific banner? Because so much of what you say that in the Taiwan's the showcase its soft power and to showcase its democracy. I see Taiwan doing that. I see its president doing that. I see its people doing that. I see its civil society doing that. Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. They're shouting it loud. They're shouting it proud. But how can the United States government or Congress, civil society, and educational institutions provide and continue to provide legitimacy to the government of Taiwan?
Let's go back to Richard. Let's go back to Dee over there. Mm-hmm.
This is Dee from Foreign Service Association for Public Affairs. So I found that the United Front Work operations is quite similar to Chinese spying operations, and it is typically called the thousand grains of sand. People say that if the U.S. wants to snap the sands from the beach, they would use satellites, and Russians would send the troops to the shore at night to snap the sands. And Chinese would send 1,000 tourists to stamp the sands. And I think this is quite similar to how Chinese do their United Front Work operations. So since Chinese is so deeply penetrate and comprehensively penetrate the United States or other countries, how can democracies systematically and institutionally counter the operations of the CCP? Thank you.
And then the final question over here.
Thank you so much for your time. Nicholas Murray, I'm representing myself right now. My question relates to, I have two questions. One is, it seems like Washington, D.C. is becoming increasingly aware of these sorts of activities, but are there other places in the country? I mean, Hollywood was mentioned to some degree, but are there other places in the United States that should perhaps be more aware of these sorts of activities, like financial centers, for instance, in New York City, or technological centers, for instance, in Silicon Valley? Do you get the sense that Silicon Valley has an understanding of Chinese influence operations to the same degree that people in Washington, D.C. do? And I ask that question in light of what we've seen in recent months and has been discussed, mentioned at places like the Atlantic Council and the Capitol Hill National Security Forum, wherein you saw Google employees, for instance, refuse to work with the United States Air Force on Project Maven, and Amazon employees revolting against their company's partnerships with the Department of Homeland Security. These are activities, while they might be indigenous to American employees of those companies, could also be co-opted by United Front Work Group representatives in, for instance, Silicon Valley. My other question is, it pertains to what we might see in warfare, and perhaps we might already be seeing that with regards to the tariffs that are being levied back and forth and the trade war that's starting to erupt between the United States and China. And we see in Xinhua and CGTN, for instance, interviewing farmers and industries in red states as being victims of Chinese counter-tariffs to the United States. So it seems to me like the Chinese are almost in some way already engaged in political warfare activities relating to the tariffs, and also promoting how those things are undermining, say, the Trump administration, and they're promoting that in Chinese media. I was wondering if you guys might comment on that. Thank you.
Great. So, a great set of first round of questions. So, we have the TRA and extending legitimacy to Taiwan as a countermeasure to political warfare. The level of penetration. How do you respond to that with such a deep level of penetration? Looking at United Front in financial sectors and tech sectors, and also terrorists as a sort of the sort of ongoing trade friction as a and targeting of terrorists as a means of political warfare.
So let me just bite off just a couple
sure. Okay.
State
sure. Yeah,
pieces
please.
Of
mm-hmm.
that. Mm-hmm. The first on the Silicon Valley front. At one level, I think Silicon Valley knows exactly what the Chinese government is and is happy to engage on its own terms when it serves them. And for further proof, you can look at the recent story about Apple and the Taiwan flag being blocked on Chinese iOS. And that only came to light because people were sending text messages saying, what are you saying? You're not making sense. And the person would say, I sent you a Taiwan flag. And the other person says, no, you didn't. That's because Apple made this change behind the scenes, didn't tell anybody about it. That's also tied into the fact that Apple has quite demonstrably, in the recent past, been willing to show up at events that the Chinese government has convened, like the Wuhan Internet Conference, or to generally be sympathetic to those things. So at that level, I think that the top leaders know what the Chinese government is and what it will take to do business there eventually. But also at another level, I think there's probably a tendency among Silicon Valley to look at the Chinese tech sector and say, you know what, they're just like us, right? I mean, they say all the right things. We want to sort of not do evil, and they want to not do evil, and they're just being pressured, and we all have the same slogans and the same outlook and so on. I'm not sure there's really a more nuanced understanding of the ways in which, especially at the leadership level, there are tie-ins with the party, and where leaders of tech companies are, if at one point they were able to be more independent, increasingly in the recent past, they're no longer able to fully be so independent, and they're increasingly either susceptible to pressure or willingly going along with the objectives of the Chinese government in order to advance their businesses. And the second point, just very briefly on the penetration issue, I do think we have to be careful in how we frame this. I think because of globalization, we are all deeply intertwined with one another, and it is highly unlikely that we, democracies and authoritarian regimes and all the rest of it, are going to become suddenly unentwined. So it's about how we condition the nature of that entanglement and that entwinement, and that's where perhaps legislation such as that introduced in Australia and other types of legislation introduced in democracies to shed sunlight on some of these more covert activities is absolutely necessary. But I would not want the idea that, democracies are being penetrated by the Chinese population to be the one that informs this type of work going forward. I think that would be sort of an unhealthy rubric for it to be put under.
Shanti?
So I think that Shanti said she put it very well in terms of Silicon Valley. I just want to double down on that a little bit. I don't think that companies are not fundamentally democratic. They operate by whatever gives them the bottom line. And to the extent that appearing to want to push back at the U.S. government is good for them, and they're able to do that. Apple or whoever can be like, we're not going to give you our encryption keys or whatever. They can do that here, and it is shocking to me and stunning that a place like Apple, when it comes to a different government, so not the U.S. government, but a different government, will just roll right over because that's where the money comes from. And I think that is something that needs to kind of reframe how we view capitalism. That's something that you know, in the past few years has kind of become popular to say, you know, or become more well understood that there is, that, you know, there is liberal capitalism and there's illiberal capitalism. And, you know, China, if you want to call it sharp power, they have learned how to use capitalism to project illiberal, you know, power abroad. And I think certainly that's happening in Silicon Valley and it's happening in Hollywood. And like that's a very severe problem that I don't think we've even begun to know how to address from a standpoint of democratic values. In terms of, again, United Front networks, right, in DC there's a growing understanding of what the United Front Work Department is. The two other places where it's a really severe problem are New York City and the entire state of California. And so if you want to follow someone who's doing really good work on that, you should follow Nick Dorfman. He's the best on this. He's based in California, and he's coming out with some really great work on that. But there are it's a very, very severe problem in both of these locations, and I don't think that there's a sort of civil society or a public understanding that this is a problem. And I'll leave it there.
So I'll try to answer the first two questions about the Taiwan Relations Act. I mean, I think that it's time for the United States to be less apologetic about its relationship with Taiwan, and that we need to make efforts to engage Taiwan on its own terms, because it is a qualitative good to engage Taiwan, not because of the hyphenation of China-Taiwan, right? That I think we need to, because of the very things we talked about, because of Taiwan's vibrant democracy, it is in and of itself a qualitative good that we need to promote and to encourage and to protect. And so the things that we've done, including the Taiwan Travel Act that helps to upgrade our relationship with Taiwan, I think is all to the good. I think we need to insist that we to make clear that we have our own interpretation of the One China policy, that we're not going to get rolled over by China's version of the One China policy. And I think that those are all important ways, I think, of protecting, you know, providing that protective shell around Taiwan. I think this issue about the penetration, I'm going to focus more on the possibility of, from a military security perspective on Taiwan, which is that my reading of history is that these types of fifth column things where they come out in the open in times of crisis of war, they tend to fizzle. If you think about the historical record, the one in which a rising of people coming out and actually overturning a regime because of the sudden outburst of these fifth column folks, the only example I can really think of in modern history is the Russian Revolution. Let's go through the other ones where they failed. Easter Uprising, failure. China's own Nanchang Uprising, failure. Algeria Rising, failure. The Tet Offensive, really, frankly, when the Viet Cong came out, they got wiped out, failure. Partly because the people that are rising up are people who are, you know, scum, right? They're your mortal enemies, right? And think about the Tet Offensive. When they came out, and the local South Vietnamese realized what the Viet Cong was about, they could not succeed because the local population turned their backs on them. So I think as long as, again, Taiwan remains true to itself, I remain confident that the Taiwanese population won't be turned as a result of these, you know, fifth column forces inside of Taiwan. That when they come out in the open, my hope is that if my reading of history is correct, those folks who come out in the open will be in trouble.
We have time for one more round of questions. Okay, let's see. We have someone right there. Okay, Rich.
Hi, Matt Turpin. Last night, FireEye, a cybersecurity firm, released a report on a Chinese espionage group targeting Cambodia ahead of its elections in July of this year, and connected it to sort of broader economic espionage work that they've been doing. Just wanted to see if that, you know, how do you see this sort of cyber activity connecting to United Front work and other interference that the Chinese have been doing, and what this means in terms of intervention and manipulation of election activities?
Interesting. Okay. I think Paul in the back of that.
follow up on Baton's question. Should there be increased communication, cooperation between U.S. intelligence and Taiwanese intelligence, specifically FBI and Taiwan's National Security Bureau? Because I know for a fact, so far, the channel, the exchange is minimal.
And just take, all right, we have a couple more hands here. Let's get these, let's hopefully get these questions in here too also as well. This gentleman here. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. My name is Chris Cruz. I had a question. We talked a bit about how the U.S. policy of the work of Taiwan is going to influence home and among other Western democracies, our allies. My question is, what can we do to help counter or help other countries in developing the world, developing democracies who may not be our allies, who may be suspicious of our motives, to help combat this kind of influence?
Interesting. Jennifer.
Jennifer Chang with U.S. Institute of Peace. My question is for Bethany. How does the CCP create much disinformation regarding ethnic minority groups in China, particularly the Muslim population, given racism and homophobia in China? What role does the other Chinese foreign actors play in
this? So my name is Juan Villa, and my comment, or question, is that I've heard a lot of, I would say, over-reliance on the rhetoric of liberal democracy, and you know, in the era of Brexit, and all the major changes around the world, I think that it's a false narrative. And if you're going to emphasize democracy versus authoritarianism, then the countries that become more authoritarian will gravitate towards China's side. But, however, I see the counter-narrative that's rising behind liberal democracy is national sovereignty. And it's certainly a very cogent issue for, you know, our president, but also Taiwan. And in my view, if you emphasize the rhetoric of national sovereignty, you know, against an expansionist power like China, then I think that will be a more convincing argument if you were to emphasize shared values, etc.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you. Okay, and this is close out all our questions. So we have one on cyberspace and how that how's that used for United Front activities with a reference to the Cambodia. Intel sharing, capacity building among, you know, among non-democratic partners, CCP disinformation towards the Muslim community, and the narrative question about how we frame the narrative, how that impacts this between democracy versus authoritarian and national sovereignty. All right. Who wants to take the first crack?
Okay, I'll take a very short first crack.
Okay.
With respect to the Cambodia example, I don't have a great deal of additional information on that besides obviously the FireEye report itself, but I do think this is one of the things that prompted me to raise sort of the disinformation piece as a key concern, because I think it indicates a growing willingness to engage in these kinds of exploits that are deliberately intended to disrupt democracies, which is, again, something very much out of the Russian government playbook. Traditionally, China hasn't been seen in that way. You know, it's sort of the, you know, we're just going to do our thing, you guys do your thing, and we have this long-term approach and so on. And so this is really the first time that I think attention has been concentrated on something specifically election-related outside of Taiwan, I would say, which obviously there's been a lot of highlights of that. So I would love to pay more attention to this, and I hope folks are doing that. I'm sure they are in the U.S. and elsewhere. And as you know, with respect, I'll just touch on the sovereignty versus values question. Of course, I'm from the National Endowment for Democracy, so I do genuinely think that democratic values are democratic values, not necessarily democratic countries all of the time, because none of us can ever hope to always live up to those values. But those values do carry an inherent appeal. The sovereignty issue, I think, can be very powerful, but to me, I always find it a little tricky because China also makes a sovereignty argument. It has for years. It said, you know, we don't interfere in your affairs, Cambodia notwithstanding. And that's actually carried a lot of weight with folks and in the developing world. And so I think it's always a little bit of a double-edged sword to invoke sovereignty, for me, the values argument, even though democracies certainly are in a difficult time right now and perhaps not all are living up to those values. But the inherent appeal is still there, in my mind.
On the issue of intelligence sharing between the FBI and Taiwan, yes, let's have more of that, if possible. On the issue of national sovereignty, so again, I would completely agree with Shanti. I think it's a double-edged sword, and I think it's insufficient. So for example, if we want to say like this is going to be the main way that we push back against, you know, what China is doing in other countries. Yes, like that would be, you know, a way to like a blunt shield against, you know, how can you do this? You always say that you don't, you know, interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries. You know, you're being hypocritical and wrong. Like that would be useful for that. But that would be super not useful for issues like the 300,000 Uyghurs who are currently being, you know, put in concentration camps in Xinjiang. That's, you know, there are international issues related to that, but mostly that's happening in Xinjiang. And so if we're saying that's the basis on which we're going to relate to China, what about the Uyghurs? You know, what about all these sort of internal, very severe human rights problems? And, you know, this was the main reason that the entire word genocide was created after World War II, because part of what was happening was, and there was already a concept that war crimes are bad, but what if you're killing vast segments of your population and it's not a wartime and it's only inside your own borders? There was no legal framework at that time that made that illegal or made that wrong or made that bad. And so national sovereignty is insufficient for a better world, and I think that's kind of what we care about here. That's sort of the larger issue that we're talking about is what is a better world, right? Then what was there? Oh, the disinformation about inside of China, and maybe Shanti would be better on this. Since it's disinformation, but I would say that generally, I don't really know if United Front Networks are so involved in that, but generally the way that the party approaches these issues is by saying, look at all the happy dancing minorities. They really love the party. You know, the Tibetans are happy, the Uyghurs are happy, everyone's happy. We don't really have a problem with Islamophobia. So that's not disinformation, that's propaganda, which I guess is maybe a kind of disinformation. But that's sort of like the line that you get on that. And so about developing countries or sort of fragile or vulnerable democracies. So what we've been talking about a lot of is, you know, the CCP's arsenal against established mature democracies. It's different when you have a country like Cambodia or, you know, various, you know, countries on the African continent or in Central Asia that, you know, are not democracies whatsoever or are pseudo-democracies or on some kind of spectrum. They don't need to be so subtle. They can just go, you know, to the leader and be like, hey, you know, we're going to have this infrastructure deal. You're just not going to criticize us and that's going to be fine, right? And, you know, the local strongman or dictator was like, yep. Fine, that's great. So they don't need some of these more subtle tools because they're not dealing with like a well-established civil society that needs to be very carefully, you know, brought over to China's side, because they can use the more traditional, harder elements of power.
So just very quickly, I assumed that there was intel sharing, but clearly I assumed wrong. So there are clearly gaps of knowledge that we need to fill. We need to know better about that relationship and to upgrade it comprehensively. Developing countries, yeah, I thought was fascinating was the incident with the New York Times reporting of the debt diplomacy in Sri Lanka and the huge pushback that came out of China, because we clearly hit a sore spot by exposing one of the things that they were doing. I think that's again, that highlights the fact that exposure, bringing sunlight to the problem, actually can put China on its back heels. And finally, the United Front writings take heart in the fact that the Western model is apparently not functioning well or has demonstrated dysfunction. I think we've been far more resilient, and I think we need to prove the party wrong. We proved the party wrong after the financial crisis. They were convinced after 2008 that we were in terminal decline, right? And they've had to reevaluate the resilience of the United States and the capitalist system. They could not believe when we had a government shutdown that we could function, right? Which reflects in some ways a fundamental misunderstanding of how democracies function, or the American democracy functions, right? Our day-to-day lives do not rely on the federal government, right? It's all about local politics, local municipalities that actually run our lives. It's a fundamental misunderstanding on the part of the Chinese. So I think one of the things we need to do is to prove the Chinese wrong in their assessment about the inherent vulnerabilities and weaknesses of democracy.
Well, with that, that brings our session today to a close. I think you all agree that with such a thought-provoking discussion, it raises more questions than really provides the answers. And so, but that gives think tanks like GTI and others to engage more on these questions. And last but not least, I want to again extend our thanks to the Seeger Center for co-sponsoring today's event. This wouldn't have been possible without the co-sponsorship.